is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And I am really pleased to have with me for the first hour here in the studio, Kimon Freeman, activist with at D.C. Ferguson, at Black Lives Matter D.C., award-winning playwright, program director, We Act Radio, which is 103.1 FM right here in Washington, D.C., and the website is We Act Radio, we as in W. I had the second half of a root canal done this morning, so the whole left side of my face
and
is numb.
And you still came to work.
But if it sounds like I'm not talking real clearly, that's why, because my left side of my tongue doesn't work.
I thought you had some Jack Daniels or something.
That would be nice. Yeah. We Act Radio, weactradio.com, dcferguson.org. And Kimon, welcome.
It's glad to be here with you, America's number one progressive talk show host. That's not saying much, because who else is doing it?
Yeah, well, you know, we're moving along.
Yes, you're chugging along, and you have Henry David Thoreau quotes in here. This is wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I there's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to talk to you about. And by the way, if anybody wants to call in and get into the, but I wanted to talk about Black Lives Matter. I want to talk about the work that you're doing. I wanted to talk about We Act Radio. I wanted to talk about microaggressions, and what triggered this for me was you were on my TV show, what, two nights ago?
Yeah.
As I recall. And after we got done, talking, and I was getting out of my chair and I was going up to another position on the set to do another thing, and I walked by and put my hand on your shoulder and said, thanks for being here. And as I jumped up on that set, I suddenly had this flashback to 1979, and Dick Gregory and I were flying across the Atlantic Ocean going to Uganda.
Really?
and just, you know, hanging out and talking, and yeah, we it's a whole long story, but and he was telling me this story, and I can't tell it as well as he does, and wouldn't try, but the essence of it was, he was on Jack Parr's show back in the day, mm-hmm. in the late 50s, early 60s, something
Big show.
Like that. Yeah, it was then, and he was talking about how Jack Parr, basically said good job, sorta, mm-hmm. but used the N word and slapped him in the butt. And he turned around and just like went off on him, and it as I was walking by and I put my hand on your shoulder, what was in my heart was that was great,
right?
But it suddenly hit me, you know, I recalled that, and I recalled the story that Andy Shalal told me on the air on TV.
Mm-hmm.
He said that when he's training, he owns the
Bus Boys and Poets.
There you go, Bus Boys and Poets. These restaurants here in town.
And Eatonsville.
Yeah, and he said when he's training his wait staff, he trains them about race. He says, you know, we got to talk about race. And the example that he gave on the air was, he said, what he tells his wait staff is, if a white couple comes in and the restaurant's mostly empty, put them alone. Put them in a place where they'd be alone, because generally, that's their preference. He said, if a black couple comes in, put them near other people, because if they're put where they're alone, they're going to think that they're being segregated. And he said, there's actually, you know, there's this kind of different response as the result of different life experiences, different growing up experiences. And, you know, having been a white guy for 60 plus years, and I try to have an idea what it's like to be black or grow up black, but I have no clue, frankly, any more than I have a clue what it would be like to grow up a woman, which you don't know either. I mean, you know, we all have to acknowledge this. And so I wanted to talk about was it Michelle Alexander who coined the phrase microaggression, or does that precede
I'm not
her?
Sure.
But
I'm
just
not
these
sure.
little slights mm-hmm. that people experience throughout their lives. Now we're seeing this whole thing about doing psychological profiles and African Americans in the United States. Even at fairly, you know, I mean, like Eric Holder level, having basically PTSD from growing up in a society that terrorizes black people. So anyhow, I've been riffing here for 5 minutes. It's your turn. I'd like to hear your thoughts on all that stuff?
Well, first I'd like to say that I didn't perceive that as a way to go boy or as a partner did with Dick Gregory, who's a great example of art and activism.
Oh, yeah.
His daughter, Ayanna Gregory, is also a great artist, a great friend of mine who lives here in D.C. Yeah. And so I'm very familiar with Bob and Dick Gregory. So thank you for sharing that story. But, you know, I was here with the invitation of your wonderful staff to have me on. I think he was on vacation, a much-deserved one. And I was promoting our play that I was actually doing at the time at Busboys and Poets. Mm-hmm. And it was called Angry Black Man in Therapy, Whites Only, #ABMIT. And the first performance we did, nobody was in the house. The last performance we did, it was sold out and it, at the Howard Zinn Room in Hinesville. And so I'm very thankful for that. But it's a piece in the play where I tell this story because I used to work with the Summer Youth Employment Program. My first job was Marion Barry's Summer Program. And if people wanted to know, for those out, you know, in your audience who don't know why DC loves Marion Barry, it's because he gave every kid a meaningful job, okay? And then the kid grew up being loyal to the guy that gave him his first meaningful job. So when politicians start having that type of impact on people's lives, then you will have that type of support and loyalty. Just want to put that out there.
Yeah.
So I'm at my
first. In fact, Dick Gregory introduced me to Marion Barry.
Is that right?
Pardon my interrupting.
No problem. It's a conversation without a beer.
Yeah.
So I'm at my first meaningful job. It was Ross Dixon and Masbeck. And the lead partner, something Ross, who was not a liberal, mind you. He was a friend of Ronald Reagan. His pride possession was this picture of him with Ronald Reagan in the White House, right? Mm-hmm. That was his pride possession. He owns land on Balboa Island off the coast of California, which is like the most expensive real estate outside of Manhattan. And so we had this Christmas party, and here I'm sitting in the bar with a millionaire, a senior partner, friends with the president, and he says, he leans over to me, he's in drunk now, because that's why I realized that alcohol is true, sir. Mm-hmm. So whenever I see people drinking, I listen intently, okay, because a drunk man's words is a sober man's thoughts. And so he leans over to the bar, and he says, Kimon, I just want you to know you're just as good as me. I said, thank you, Mr. Ross. I appreciate that. He's like, no, damn it, I mean it. You're just as good as me, and don't you ever forget it. And I said, okay, great. You know, Mr. White Man, with your arm around my shoulder, I'm making $7.25. Why don't you give me a raise? He just laughed. Ha, 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 ha.
Right.
But I never forgot that because of our experiences of a lot of people have an elitist experience coming from, you know, I don't want to assume that all white people have come from a privileged background, but there is a disproportionate amount of privilege in the white experience in America and a history of underprivilege in the black experience in America.
Yeah.
And so when we go through that, we tend to think that somehow something is wrong with us and something is good with them, you know, because we have a society that says, oh, look at this guy. He has $50 billion. He's a genius. He's a wonderer. He's this. He's great. And look at all these 5 billion people that have nothing. They're ignorant. They're poor. This poor thing. Then they don't realize, no, the guy with $50 billion robbed 55 billion people, and that's right. How he got, you know, it's not, so it's inequity.
Or his daddy did.
Right, right. Or his daddy, I mean, inherited.
Like Trump.
You know, it's a scene, this is one of the things I love about social media. I know Twitter and Facebook are glorified advertising agencies, commodified our relationships, and monitor the flow of information, but it's a necessary evil in this day and age. Having said that, there's this image of these kids watching a baseball game. Looking over the fence, okay? They don't have tickets. They're trying to look over the fence to watch the baseball game. There's one kid on different stair, but the tallest kid is on the high step. He should be on the lower step so he can still see over the fence. The shortest kid should be on the high step so he can see over the fence too.
Right.
That's equality, and that's what we're trying to get to. And that comment from that man that day gave me a lift up on that step to see over the fence.
That's interesting. We're talking with Kimon Freeman. Activist with Black Lives Matter and program director of We Act Radio. And
this is the Tom Hartman Program.
An award-winning playwright and all kinds of other cool stuff. We'll be back. Your calls and our conversation. Stick around. And there's a bunch of other stuff we're going to get into today as well. Stick around. Well, welcome back. And you want to pick up some calls here?
Yes, let's do it.
Okay. Charles, watching Free Speech TV in Mount Vernon, New York. Hey, Charles, you're on the air with me and Kimon.
I have family in Mount Vernon, New York.
Charles, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Money, yeah, I can hear him. Money, Yoni, and Mount Vernon.
I had to call in with the two latest incidents with the with Miss Bland.
Yeah, you got to listen to your telephone, Charles. If you're listening to your television, if your television's even on, it'll totally disorient you because there's about a half a minute delay.
And Mr. DuBois in Cincinnati.
Okay. Yeah. So the point you wanted to make?
Okay, I got the volume turned down.
Thank you.
I'm 68 years old, black man. I was a New York City police officer for about 9 years. I was a training officer within that.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw the incident with Miss Bland, I was totally outraged.
Yeah.
I saw the video, the dash cam of the officer, and the officer was coming up so fast behind Miss Bland that he was either going to have a collision with her or she had to move over. There was no violation of law there.
Yeah.
The rules are when an emergency vehicle comes behind you, you move over.
Yeah.
You move to the right. And then he exacerbated the situation.
Yeah, I think he set it up.
He actually did a U-turn on this dash cam video to confirm that he actually did a U-turn when she passed him. He turned around and then chased her. And as you just indicated, his speed could very well have been the cause of her changing the lane in the first place.
Yeah.
Which I think is semantics, is having the right to pull over at this point is a moot point. I'm more concerned with the fact what happened next. Her being arrested or dragged out that vehicle was a crime.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened to her next was a crime. So, but thank you for making that point. But I'm trying to launch a campaign here in D.C. called FTP, Female Treatment Protection. It is making it illegal for male cops to put their hands on female cops. It's already prohibited for them to search a female. So if they can't search a female, why should they have the right to put their hands on a female to begin with? Because they can brutalize them, they can beat them, but they can't search them. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. In an effort to wrestle community control over the police, I think this is the first important step, and I hope that people will take the time to go to Credo Mobile and look for the Female Treatment Protection Program, FTP. You may have trouble with the search engine because the Fraternal Order of Police carries a lot of weight, and a lot of people are not happy about anything that is going to get them to share power. So please contact me. Come on, Freeman. I'm sure it's on the screen. I'm also on Facebook, and you'll see postings there. So I hope people would do something about this. And let me say this. My brother, if you're really outraged, make sure that people take their money out of Bank of America, out of Morgan Chase, and out of Wells Fargo, because all three of these institutions, who are too big to jail, mind you, invest heavily in private prisons in this country, so they're making money off the suffrage and incarceration of black people in America.
Amazing. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back with Kimon Freeman and me here on the Tom Hartwood Program. Stick around. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, Kimon Freeman with me, and who you can find on Facebook, you can find all over the internet.
Yes, on Twitter, I'm a guerrilla artist on Twitter.
There you go. And it, with the backdrop of Samuel DuBose having his face shot off in about 3 seconds by a white cop who was just being oh so friendly, and then all of a sudden, bang. And the story over on Alternet, 5 black women have been found dead in jail in the last month. It's not just Sandra Bland. And then last night, somebody put Confederate flags all around Martin Luther King's church, the Ebenezer Baptist Church. This is grim stuff. Anyhow, you were talking about.
Well, I was saying off air that Harry Belafonte, one of my greatest heroes is alive, says that the agenda is to find the agenda, and so we're all scratching our heads on how do we begin to brick by brick dismantle white supremacy. How do we wrestle community control over our rogue police force? And I testified at the 21st Century Presence Task Force on 21st Century Policing here in D.C. was at the museum. I met the president of the Fraternal Order of Police. I met the president of the police union, and I can tell you, this is the good old boys network. And the entire panel was, with the exception of the mayor of Sacramento, yes, the mayor of Sacramento, you know, it was a love fest. It was talking about how well the police are doing and how much crime is down. And yes, we have a few broken eggs here and there, but you know, that's just, you know, collateral damage. You know, it's you know, it's casualties of war. It was the attitude that they had, and I don't accept that. I spoke about this, but I thought long and hard after seeing this. It's just such a sham, is what it is, because it was not putting forth any structural changes, and it definitely wouldn't address any of the calls for justice. Because mind you, all this is still happening, and if some accounts is escalating, so you have to ask yourself, how do we have a black president? How do we have a black attorney general? And we have this problem at this level of epic levels. It has been increased. Cell phones didn't just come out. This is not new technology. Social media did not just come out. That's not new technology. It's because we have armed good old boy network who have asserting themselves because they want to make sure that you know who's really in charge. And they want to make sure that you know that they can do this to you and nothing is going to happen. This is how it's always been. And by and large, this is what's going to be. You know, and I think that's the attitude that's running through this. We have white supremacist, racist people with guns and badges, and they're enjoying their work. And until we acknowledge that, we're not going to be able to wrestle a sharing of power, because I need to hear someone say in a position of authority that any officer that breaks the public trust will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Yes, we've seen police officers charged. I'm not celebrating until I see police officers convicted.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. And you're doing this FTP program. I want you to talk about that briefly. And let me just set that up, if I may. Women were the last to get the vote. Mm-hmm. Women were, prior to the 1920s, women could not even make a will independently. There had to be a male executor. They couldn't own property. They couldn't decide who their children would go to if they died. They couldn't decide, or if their husband died, they couldn't decide the religion in which a male executor would be appointed to take charge of them. Mm-hmm. You know, we're running this on our newscast, actually, at the bottom of the hour. And now we've got, you know, we've got five black women who have died in jail in the last month. But oh, where I was going with that, in 1961, the birth control pill became widely available. 1973, we had Roe v. Wade. Suddenly, women had control over their bodies. They had control over reproduction. And that, I believe, was a major kicking off point for the women's movement, the modern women's movement. Women got power in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And now there's this really aggressive push on the part of the Republicans, and we're seeing this with these doctored videos coming out of Planned Parenthood, to take away from women that basic reproductive power, the power over their own bodies, which I believe is part of, it's not just white privilege or white supremacy, it's white male supremacy. And arguably male supremacy in general. And so you're pushing back on this, at least with regard to the police, on the FTP program. Tell us about that.
Well, if we can agree that men have no right to put their hands on women, I don't see what's so controversial about extending that to the police. Again, it's as if they have different sets of rules. Yeah. I just want to give a little quick history lesson for your audience. A lot of people don't know this, that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from France.
Yeah.
And it was originally a statue of a black woman. And those African features was too much for Americans to stomach. And so they sent it back to give it a facelift, you know, to do a little Michael Jackson on it. And so when it comes back, that's when you see the current image you have. And if you go to the Statue of Liberty, you will actually see, because as an artist, there was a true artist, I wish I can give it the guy's name, who tried to hold on to his integrity, he left a chain around the foot of the Statue of Liberty. So if you go to the Statue of Liberty, you'll see a chain still on the foot of the Statue of Liberty. That's the only thing he could sneak in of the original presentation. And so why am I saying that is that the image of the black woman has been, you know, from that moment to now under attack, because from slavery to now, we could not protect her. She was a concubine of their master. That's why they even had laws that the freedom of the child is determined by the lineage of the mother. So if the mother was a slave, the child was a slave. You know, so this is just a concerted effort of American history. You know, so I just want to put that out there. I was just on PFW. You had mentioned in 103.1 was the first low power FM signal in the nation's capital, but the SEC had not approved our antenna location yet, so we have not turned that on. So hopefully, if we got some SEC people out there that actually believe in media, they could speed that up. But until that happens, WPFW is the best game in town, in the nation's capital. And we was just on the air, and we was talking about, with all these women killed, where are the feminists out here? Where are the feminists being outraged about this? Where's those groups? Where are the libertarians, for that matter, about police violence? Yeah. You know, they're supposed to be so against government, and there's government at executing people in the street.
Yeah.
You know? So where's that support? It's kind of like Ronald Reagan and the NRA. They have a problem taking the guns away from the Black Panthers.
Yeah.
They took their guns.
Yeah.
Knowing that and the NRA didn't say anything.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's white supremacy. Right.
Okay. We'll be back with Kimon Freeman. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we'll pick up your calls after the news here at the bottom of the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Kimon Freeman in the studio with me. Black Lives Matter activist, award-winning playwright, program director at We Act Radio here in Washington, D.C., weactradio.com. And where do we go with this conversation, or you want to pick up a phone call?
Let's take a phone call.
Okay.
Shout out to the Baltimore Orioles, though.
Why is that?
Yeah, because the owner of the Baltimore Orioles was very supportive of the Baltimore uprising. He said that, you know, they tried to bait him into denouncing the riots by saying, how do you feel about the violence happening in your city? He said, well, of course we're against violence, all forms of violence. We're against the poverty and the undereducation and the police brutality and the wars. And then like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, that was the owner's Baltimore Orioles son, position. I think he runs the team. And then they also tried to corner, what's my brother's name? The general manager, Buck. Mm-hmm. I think his name's Buck. Shout out to Buck. And they asked Buck after a game, post-game conference, what type of advice would he give to the looters? He says, well, I don't know. You should ask them. You know, I know I've been black. And I don't know what they had to go through. And I don't know what the struggle is for them. And you don't either.
Yeah.
You know, you should talk to them.
Yeah.
You know? So shout out to Baltimore Orioles. And then when they did a game with an empty stadium, that was the real reason why you saw them parade those police officers out there the way they did, because that was affecting money.
Yeah, that's powerful stuff.
So I really appreciate them for making a stand. They've been giving out free tickets to kids ever since.
Yeah. Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
I'm a little upset with some of the hits that black politicians have had to take for white politicians, and I'm going to go down the list. Colin Powell had to go before the UN and basically try to make the case for WMDs in Iraq.
He had to lie.
Yeah.
And he knew it wasn't true. I've read comments by him. He said, this is just not true, and he used a little bit more graphic language. But it wasn't Rumsfeld, or it wasn't Cheney, or it wasn't anyone else who went out there. It was Colin Powell. And he had to take the hit, and I think that is not a coincidence.
You think, Alan, that George Bush was sitting around, George Bush and Dick Cheney were sitting around going, we got to lie the world into this. Who, you know, how are we going to do this? And Dick Cheney says, oh, let's get the black guy to do it.
Yeah.
Conspiratorial, but, you know, Colin Powell did have the military experience. He had the gravitas that none of those other guys had.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure exactly what the thinking was, but it wouldn't surprise me, but I can't say because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And then secondly, after Benghazi, Hillary Clinton, you know, she's not feeling well. Who takes the hit? Susan Rice, a black woman. She goes on the Sunday shows, and that kind of, you know, doesn't help her career. And I feel that's very unfair. Whatever you think of Benghazi, what was Susan Rice having to go out there on Sunday and defend everything?
You know, I'm Alan, thank you for the call. Colin Powell was a decorated war hero, a very high credibility figure. Yeah, I think it's probable that the Bush administration pushed him out there not because he was black, but because he was the guy that had the credibility to sell it to the rest of the world. And maybe being black would help that with, you know, a large part of the world that's not white. But I don't know.
Well, Harry Belafonte would dispute whether he was actually black, though. But
you want to talk about that?
Yeah, Harry Belafonte had an ongoing feud with Colin Powell. They was both Caribbean and from similar backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds. And he was just making a notion that, you know, he was a house Negro that was doing the bidding of the master. And that's exactly what he did there. And he was more than willing to do that. And so was Condoleezza Rice and Clarence Thomas and millions of others who've been successful in this country. That type of blackness is acceptable. The unforgivable blackness is when you have the audacity like a Cynthia McKinney or someone to go against the grain and speak out against what's going on. I met Colin Powell at the National Press Club a couple of months ago. And my own friends, people that know me and supposed to like me, I guess, I don't know if they love me or not, but they criticized me because I refused to shake his hand. Hmm. They felt that I disrespected him by refusing to shake his hand. I'm like, I'm not under any obligation to shake anybody's hand, you know. Hmm. I didn't call him a house Negro like Harry Belafonte did. I didn't attack him, but I asked him. I'm like, what do you think now about would you have done things differently? He said, well, you know, they gave me, you know, faulty information and, you know, woo. And I'm looking at him like, okay, so if their intelligence community can't get it right, so, and this is millions of lives have been lost as a result of this. And, of course, billions of dollars have been made as a result of this. It doesn't look good to me at all. And I think that we need to be mindful that black faces in high places should not be room for comfort. So I would go along with you saying that they might not have gotten him because he was black, but it definitely did help with his credibility.
But if Colin Powell had been white with the exact same CV background, not necessarily the life experience, but, you know, the same college, the same went into the military, same war hero, all that stuff, I think a white guy would have been honored to be Secretary of State. I mean, you know, it's so what's wrong, or Condi Rice or anybody else? I mean, why should a person say, no, I'm not going to be part of a white administration because I'm black?
It's not about being a part of a white administration. I would have been honored to have worked with Paul Wellstone, I believe his name. I would have been honored to work with Howard Zinn. I would have been honored to ride with John Brown. That's not the issue. The case is that you're serving the bidding of a fascist, imperialist regime. That's what the Bush administration was. And make no mistake about it, I'm still not convinced about what truly happened in 9/11. I'm quoting the Boondocks right now. This is a quote from the Boondocks. Don't hate me, hate the Boondocks. Ronald Reagan was a devil, Jesus was black, and the government's lying about 9/11. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of holes in their story. There was a flight, a TWA flight. 800, I believe.
Yeah, Flight 800.
What happened to Flight 800, Tom?
I think the best story is that the Navy was doing missile exercises off the coast and they shot it down. But, you know,
they shot it down, and you know, we can speculate whether they shot it down because they haven't admitted. Let's go about the facts of what they admitted, because people talk about conspiracies. Let's go about what they have admitted to. They admitted to, like you said, they was doing military exercises,
right.
Firing.
Right.
They admitted that they was in the area and that they fled the area after the plane went down.
Right.
Those are the facts. So you come to your own conclusions after that.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm talking about. We should not be a part of that just because it's beneficial to us financially, our career, and what have you. Plenty of people work for Walmart. They don't support Walmart, but no one's dying as a result of Walmart. But people are dying working with Lockheed Martin. People are dying in this administration that is funding these drones programs and the largest military industrial complex on the planet that President Eisenhower warned us about. So that is what we're talking about. But that is the number one game in town. And I'll let you push back, but I wanted to make sure I come back with a story I have for you.
Okay, if I may. I mean, isn't there a certain danger to that purity? I mean, because I've heard that same argument about, for example, Bernie Sanders. This guy has been independent his whole entire life, and now he's inside the Democratic Party running for president. And there are folks who are saying, you know, he should run as an independent. He should do a Ralph Nader. And you know, the reality is, if he wants to actually become president, he's got to become part of the system. How do you maintain your integrity? And I think Bernie will be able to maintain his integrity, but you know, how do you maintain your integrity if you're saying, because I see this as a corrupt system, I'm not going to get inside it and conceivably try to change it?
I don't want to discourage anyone, but history has shown us that more often than not, you do not change the system changes you. And if you are strong enough to resist that, then you don't get to stay around too long. So I applaud anyone who has the audacity to take on the system full force, like Bernie Sanders is talking about, because he is really talking about turning capitalism on his head.
Yeah.
And I support him in that. I think he needs to do a better job in making sure there's a black agenda. I think he needs to do a better job in making sure that if he's not successful, that because of you know, our allegiance to the Democratic Party and our fearfulness of the Republicans, that we must automatically and blindly support Hillary. I disagree with that as well. Hillary voted for the Iraq war, by the way. I want to remind everyone that we're supposed to be ready for Hillary. And I just want to put that out there. But let me say this. I had two neighbors. I was renting a basement apartment here in D.C., and I was a gay couple I was renting from, two gentlemen. One worked for the IMF, and the other one was a defense contractor in Iraq. The guy that worked for IMF, I had a conversation with these people over a beer, and he was basically, his area of concentration was India. He would go to India once or twice a year, and he was completely against the structural adjustment loans that he was there to enforce in India. He was against that. And his partner was a defense contractor in Iraq who was against the war in Iraq. He thought it was just for oil, and it was a bloody coup. He was against the war. I was like, why are y'all doing this if you're against it? So they pay us so well.
Yeah.
How else are we going to have this standard of living? How else are we going to pay for it? We understand it's wrong, but that's the job.
Yeah.
And so we do not have to convince people right and wrong. What we have to convince people is their morals on who they are. In God we trust, that's their power, the money, the almighty dollars, who they bow
down. Yeah, I mean, that
to.
Even goes back to the war resistors. I mean, this was big back in the 60s, not paying your taxes because you don't support the war. And there was, you know, people went to jail around that. I mean, is it?
You know, Tom, I'm going to have to say it. I've been a war tax resistor since October 16, 1995. Me personally.
Well,
the business is great. Me personally. And so, what's my brother's name? The lawyer for O.J. Simpson.
Oh, Johnny Cochran.
Johnny Cochran supported me in that. Because we in D.C. with taxation without representation is unconstitutional. I thought that was what this country was founded on.
There you go. There you go. Kimon Freeman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with your calls in just a minute. Commercial. Welcome back. Tom Hartman, Kimon Freeman here. And let's pick up some more phone calls here, Kimon. John in Birchwood, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, John, you're on the air with both of us. What's up?
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. First of all, I just wanted to let you know that your work is making a difference. 6 months ago, you can never convince me of white privilege. I'm learning from listening to you, and just want to let you know you're making a difference. My questions are, when you see this stuff on TV, especially when the police are in the wrong, it used to always be that we cannot comment about an ongoing investigation. Now when the police are wrong, I mean, they're out front giving details and information. How come? And then my second question is, are either of you afraid that with this tension that something's going to happen and this whole thing is going to blow up and we're going to end up with riots like, you know, made the race riots in the 60s look like child's play? I mean, is that a concern with any of you? Or?
Come on. Thank you, John.
Thank you for your call. Thank you for supporting Tom Hartman's program and his work. I'm not going to say that I feel that we are heading towards that, because I don't think the riots, if there are large-scale riots, it won't be based upon, unfortunately, justice against the police murders and police brutality. It would be because of the rampant inequality and inequity in this country. The haves and the have-nots. We have the United States of America has the largest disparity of wealth of any nation in the world, as far as I know, and D.C. has the largest disparity of wealth in the nation, as far as I know, and because of that, at some point we're going to reach the breaking point. Frederick Douglass said that the endurance of a tyrant, the power of a tyrant, is measured by the endurance of those whom they oppress. And at some point, it's going to be reached a breaking point. And I think we're nearing that breaking point.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think we're just another economic crash away from it. And the thing that is, I don't know if it's good news or bad news or whatever, is that the economic oppression that people of color have experienced in this country forever. Mm. White people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, that's happening to me now, too. Mm. As Reaganism creeps across America and the white middle class that pretty much didn't exist in the 1920s. I mean, in the 1920s, even white people were poor, working people. Mm-hmm. And you know, FDR brought at least white folks up as a starting point, and then LBJ, we don't need to go through history lessons mm-hmm. here, but I think that you know, the whole country is starting to wake
up. What do you think it's going to look like? You think it's going to be like the fall of the Soviet Union, or you think it's going to look like Greece?
I think it's going to look like 1929. I think that I wrote a book about this, right?
That's right. The crash of 2016.
Every 80 years, we get an economic crash followed by a war. 80 years ago, it was the crash of 29 followed by World War II. 80 years before that, it was a crash of 1856 followed by the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the crash of 1770 followed by the American Revolution. And you can take that back, actually, in these 80-year increments, all the way back to the 1400s.
Oh, wow.
In Anglo-Saxon society. And it's true of pretty much every culture. And I think it's because of what Arnold Toynbee said. He said, when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last great war dies, the next great war becomes inevitable, because we only remember the glories. You know, when Phil Gramm proposed in 1999 that we blow up Glass-Steagall, he said, you know, it's been working for 80 years. We don't need it anymore. If he had tried that in 1950, when there were people alive in Congress who still remembered the crash, he would have been laughed off the floor. But they were all dead. So anyhow, I see these cycles of history. We'll be back. We'll be right back. Yeah, got a few. We're back. Tom Hartman, Kimon Freeman, and this is interesting. David, listening on Sirius XM in San Diego, California. David, you're on the air with both of us. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate you. You are the real deal, sir.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that H.R. 40 is something that, and I'm sure hopefully you guys know about it.
That's John Conyers legislation, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
It's reparations.
Here for the last 25. No, it's not reparations. To my understanding, it's more of taking a look at the effects of slavery and what it has done and permeated throughout our nation and got us to this point. And having a committee and scholars and so forth to really delve into that. But what that does is get Americans to really bust open the egg and actually have a conversation about slavery and its past and try to put it to bed. And secondly, I know that Bernie Sanders is having issues with the Black Lives Matter situation. But if he was to embrace, and him and John Conyers are good friends, if he was to embrace this H.R. 40 and bring that onto his ideas, he would probably be in a lot better situation when it comes to how African Americans or minorities are looking at him now. It's a fantastic bill, and it should be brought to fruition. So I'll let you guys speak on that.
Cool. Thank you, David. Thank you. Thoughts? Come on.
Yeah. Let me first comfort the white people, because you're talking about a study. It was a study for reparations. No one's trying to garnish your wages like the IRS so that, you know, I can get my reparations. What we're talking about is the government making corrections and past wrongs. And you got to understand that up until the 60s, we were legally oppressed, financially, physically, you know, in every way imaginable. And to sit here and say that we have not been affected and that we just pull ourselves by our bootstraps is at best, ridiculous. So we're talking about it because reparation, you know, I'm not for just giving every black person $1 million. That's not going to solve the problem. What will happen, you have a bunch of expensive cars out here and you know, people will just be buying bigger houses and the money will go right back to where it came from. We would have to have political education. It could come in the form of free state institution, tuition, We used to be able to get it when we went to a state institution until Bill Clinton made it impossible because you could go to jail and get a degree.
Hmm.
You know, Bill Clinton made that unattainable anymore. So there was a time when you went to jail and you came out educated, you know, like a Malcolm X. And they don't want any more Malcolms. They want degenerates with a with recidivism. And so anybody that wants to correct the nature of the beast, and this study would do that, will have a problem because it affects their bottom line. We're talking about one of the largest labor unions in the country, which is prison guards. We're talking about the largest prison system in the world. You're trying to affect those numbers, you will have a lot of resistance in doing so.
Yeah. Here's another issue Richard's got driving through Illinois. Hey, Richard, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. How are you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
My comment is that, you know, ever since the 80s when, you know, Reagan showed up and the whole push for smaller government, you know, money trickles down. And the federal government's giving less to the states. The states are giving less to the local governments. And everybody's hurting for money. Most of the local police departments have turned to traffic stops as a revenue-generating source. You know, it's like one of their biggest ways to bring in cash.
Yeah.
And they concentrate most of these stops areas of, like, lower working class people of color because they know these people don't have the resources or the time to sit there and even fight something as simple as a traffic ticket. Most traffic tickets, when you get them, I know where I live, if you get a ticket, you can't even get a court date to fight it until you put – you post bail, which is usually the cost of the fine, the court costs, the whole thing. It can be, you know, $500 up front just to get a court date to fight a ticket for running a red light.
Well,
a lot of people don't have the money or the time to go through that. So it's quick, easy money for the cities. They don't do it in white areas where people are making good money because you know people are going to post that bail and they're going to show up in court. Most of these cops don't even show up in court if you get a court date. And I know this from experience because my wife got ticketed like that.
Yeah. So thank you, Richard. It's an excellent point. It's not just like institutional and structural racism. It's institutional and structural Republican or conservative stupidity. This, you know, let's strangle government that then throws it down to the cities. And then the cities are looking around going, OK, we got to do something. Let's start squeezing some money out of folks. You cops do it, and then now you're talking to an institution that really came out of slavery, the police departments in the United States. And what are they going to do? They're going to pick on people that are not going to pick back.
Yeah, I want to thank that brother for his call because he just reminded me I have an unpaid ticket in Ferguson while I was there.
Uh-oh.
So thank you. I need to take care of that. Fortunately, I'm on my bike today. I also want to point out in D.C., 90% of all arrests in D.C. is nonviolent. It's not criminals. 90% of all the arrests. So we really need, and most of these cases that we found with the police, look what Eric Garner, what was he doing?
Yeah, selling cigarettes.
What was Sandy Brown doing? What was the Sam DuBose doing? You know, these are not criminals. So we need to, you know, he has a very good point there. It's over policing. They're really trying to justify the work that they do and keep the machine fed. And we have our work cut out for us because how do we bring accountability to a group of men who are armed to the teeth and hell bent on violence?
Yeah.
You know, Officer Friendly, there's a Norman Rockwell picture, you know, of the Officer Friendly sitting at the counter in some shop. He's looking down at the kid who's an obvious runaway. You know, you remember that picture?
Yeah.
Yeah, I seen it on social media. Well, now the guy's in, you know, ride gear, you know, looking at the guy, and he's, the kid is scared, you know, right, out of his skin. You know, that's
up against the wall.
There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Kimon Freeman. Check him out on Facebook, on Twitter. At weactradio.com, dcferguson.org.
Little artist.
All over the place. There you go. Kimon, K-Y-M-O-N-E, Freeman, F-R-E-E-M-A-N. Great having you on. Thank you. We'll be back with the program after the news at the top of the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Danielle Gilday is sitting next to me, one of our associate producers. And I wanted to get a guest on.
Yes.
Who had been to a Bernie party last night, because the Bernie parties happened while I was doing a television program. We tried to play a piece of it on TV last night, and it happened, and Bernie spoke so briefly. We went to him at 7:45, and it was a woman talking about how we all got to organize. And then, so we picked up Larry Cohen. Was that his name?
Yes.
The SEI or the telecommunications workers.
Yep.
Ex-president. But so you and Shano were at a house party last night. Tell us about it.
We attended a house party for Bernie in Hyattsville, Maryland, which is, you know, our hometown. It was one of the smaller venues, according to what I'm seeing on Twitter. There was about 30 people there, and gracious hosts Steve and Tiffany, who were wonderful, opened their home to Bernie supporters and people also who wanted to learn more about Bernie. Mm-hmm. And the passion, the energy of a relatively small crowd was infectious. That everybody was having a great time. The crowd ranged literally from somebody who was still in high school, just about to turn 18, and it would be their first election to vote. And Bernie has excited them enough that they are already getting involved, all the way up to retired folks, probably, 70s, 60s, 70s maybe. A great crowd, lots of passion, lots of people who recognize the sincerity and the genuineness, if that's a word, of Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And were there any trolls there?
I suspect there was. I don't want to say for sure, because I certainly wouldn't want to label somebody as such without proof.
Well, you're pretty good at your troll detector is pretty good. I mean, you screen the phone lines here, and I do
have a little of experience picking up.
Yeah,
the questions tend to, always use the same wording, very coached, very practiced, and there was somebody that Shane and I both got a similar read from, and we got in the car afterwards and said, do you think that was a Hillary supporter? Do you think that was, maybe a Republican or somebody in disguise? And
because he just wasn't there to be supportive of Bernie.
Right, and not everybody was. There were people who, but they were honest and said, hey, it's the beginning of the election cycle. I want to be informed and involved, and I want to know who I'm voting for.
Right.
And so they were there to find out. And that's a wonderful thing. That's how the political process works and what makes our country great. But they were open and they were,
cool.
Completely honest about it versus somebody who had really convenient questions.
We have a couple of callers.
Yes.
Who about this topic, about
yes.
Bernie parties. So let's pick them up and engage them. Elaine, listening on KBAI in Bellingham, Washington, you hosted a Bernie party last night?
Yes, I did. Can you hear me all right?
We hear you fine. You can hear me?
Yep.
You hear her? Okay. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. So we had 15 people at the party, eight of whom I had never met before. It was wonderful. We had a man who was an expat, a French man who actually met Bernie twice, who had been a mayor of a small town in France. We had a woman who was an Occupy activist. We had a man who was a political scientist. He was a PhD in political science, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And so we just had a number of really intelligent, really neat people, all activists. And the outcome of the party was we all decided that we would get each other's email addresses and we would meet every month to try to get Bernie elected.
Same here.
And I want to put this out there, BernieSanders.com/work if you want to volunteer and get involved.
Cool.
Yeah, or you could text 82623 if my dyslexia said those numbers, and it'll send you the form to fill out.
Yeah, and text the word work.
Yes.
Yeah. Elaine, thank you for that. Diana, watching Free Speech TV in Agora Hills, California. You're on the air and with Tom and Daniel.
Yes. Thank you, Tom. Great show so far today. I mentioned to Danielle that I went also to a very passionate house party for Bernie yesterday. People came from outside of really the neighborhood and of a 25-mile radius, which was interesting because they wanted to – people talked about wanting to get a read about how what other people were thinking outside of their neighborhood. Mostly science and medical professionals, retired people, real estate professionals, educators, movie industry professionals. So it was 25, 26 people. There was a couple there that had traveled to Phoenix to take their 11-year-old daughter, who is very politically active, and came because she is interested in politics, so that bodes well for the future. They loved listening to Bernie in Phoenix. Now, people are angry, Tom. I thought my college students were radical. These people age range from 30 to 70. They're extremely agitated about the condition of our country today. I was stunned. They're more radical than my college students. And these are professional people. They're comfortable. These people would not necessarily be out in the streets marching, but they're adamant about supporting Bernie. They're angry at President Obama for not jailing any CEO banksters. They're very angry about the TPP, the future food quality. Again, being science people, they were very well informed about what the TPP boasts in terms of food quality. They're very concerned about the environment. They want free college and student loan debt forgiveness. Fascinating group. And here's what I was really shocked about, how angry they are about conventional corporate Democrats pushing Hillary on them. The word hate came up. The
really?
Word evil came up.
This oh my
is what
God.
I'm talking about.
This is, you know, we've got to be careful of the circular firing squad here, Diana.
Well, these people don't listen to you, Tom.
Yeah,
they did.
Apparently.
Because I asked them, I said, well, if she gets elected, she wins the primary, are you going to be voting or working for her? I was just going to ask that question because I've been listening to you this summer.
Yeah.
And they said, no, they're voting for Jill Stein. They're going to vote for the Green Party. They're that. I don't think
so. We're going to have President Scott Walker, and we're going to have the three more crazies in the Supreme Court.
But do you know what they were saying? They were saying that Democrats will not protest against a Democratic president. They've learned that lesson with President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And if a Republican gets elected, they'll be out in the streets, and people will be out in the streets. And these are oldsters. These are professional workers.
But it's a scenario that may play out, Diana. And I didn't catch this morning, but I was because I had a 7 a.m. appointment to get my root canal, second half of it done this morning. But Louise called me after I left the dentist's office, and she was watching MSNBC Morning Joe, and she said that they did a focus group of Trump supporters. And the Trump supporters were saying, we like him because he's not a politician. We're sick of politicians. And I don't think Bernie is viewed as a politician. I think he's viewed as a statesman or, you know, as certainly as a political outsider. And she was like, you know, back in 71 and with the Powell memo, Lewis Powell was saying basically we need to take control of the political system. We, the business community, need to take control of the political system. And part of that strategy was to trash the political system. And, you know, Reagan ran on, you know, the nine most dangerous words in our scary words are I'm from the government. I'm here to help. They have destroyed or ruined much of our government. They've paralyzed the rest of it. And, you know, now people are, I think they're fully awake to that. Diana, thank you for the call. And Danielle, thanks for sharing your stories with us.
Absolutely.
And we'll be back. Professor Galbraith is going to be with us. Stick around. This is going to be interesting. We're going to get into the economics of the day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Right after this break. Stick around. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And James K. Galbraith is with us. Am I saying that right?
Yeah,
I have been mispronouncing your and your father's name my whole entire life because I read, you know, I used to read all this stuff, but I didn't hear it. You know, But in any case,
if you were in Scotland, you could say Galbraith.
Galbraith. Yeah. Ah, there you go. It's a Scottish name.
Oh, sure.
Oh, that's marvelous. Yeah. Economist Lloyd M. Benson, Jr., Chair in Government and Business Relations, Professor of Government at the University of Texas in Austin, utexas.edu. And you're in town here for a Roosevelt Institute-sponsored gig or event in the Hart Senate Office Building with Joe Stiglitz and Bernie Sanders. Do I have
that's
that
right? That's correct, yeah. Coming
cool.
up in a, later on
yeah.
this afternoon.
So you're, the topic you're talking about is the Greek debt crisis, or the Greek, I would say it's a Greek democracy crisis, or it's both economic and financial mm-hmm. in that the Eurozone has not integrated politically, even though they've integrated fiscally, and it seems like that's a big problem. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's both an economic and a democracy crisis, and it's not just for Greece. It's really a crisis of the entire European system. Mm-hmm. So we have a European Union, which is founded, as the treaty says, on the principle of representative democracy. But within the Eurozone, democracy has taken a pretty hard hit from the terms that have been imposed on Greece by its creditors. And in fact, if you look at the document that the Greek government was compelled to sign under threat that its banking system would be shut down at the start of this month, that document requires the Greek government, for example, to basically get prior approval for any legislation submitted to the Greek parliament from the creditors even before it goes for public comment.
Hmm.
So the effect of that is to say, well, Greece really isn't an independent country anymore in any material sense. It's not sovereign. It has become a colony of the institutions in Brussels and other major
and
European
capitals. And in particular Germany.
Well, I'm hesitant to lay the blame solely on Germany, because in fact there's a coalition of interests that have been imposing this. There's a substantial responsibility from France for the beginning of this very dysfunctional program. And the creation of the European Central Bank also plays a role.
If we were to draw an analogy between the European situation and the United States, would it not be incorrect to suggest that Greece is Mississippi and Germany is California? California puts a lot more into the federal government than it takes out. Mississippi takes a lot more out of the federal government than it puts in, and yet nobody is sitting around saying, "Okay, Mississippi has to do austerity." Whereas in
I'm going to be careful about saying anything about California that might infuriate all my Californian friends.
Okay. Well, you can say New York State. I mean, your blue state.
But that's,
you know?
That's entirely correct. The U.S. Has the historical good fortune of having gone through the New Deal, the Great Society, and having forged. Institutions, particularly social insurance programs, but also that we have a unified federal government budget, including the military budget, which distributes spending power all around the country and makes it so exactly that the state of Mississippi isn't solely responsible for the welfare of the people who live there. They get Social Security, they get Medicare, they get Medicaid, they get unemployment insurance, they get all kinds of protections they get the earned income tax credit. That tend to even things out. So while Mississippi isn't as wealthy as New York or California, the actual differentials in the U.S. are much less than they are between, say, Germany and Portugal or France and Romania.
So the situation in Europe is actually worse than it is here in the United States.
Once you start moving things to the level of the continental arrangement,
right.
The situation in Europe is really unstable. It's
so doesn't that argue for one of two things? Either Europe becomes basically one country and becomes like the United States, becomes a federalist system, which is not going to happen any day soon, because every country would have to surrender their sovereignty, or they stop using a common currency. Or at least the marginal economies start using economies.
What the Greek government, the government of the Syriza coalition that came into power at the end of January, tried to do was to find a path between those two alternatives.
Right.
And this was something that Yanis Varoufakis and myself and another co-author named Stuart Holland were proposing, which was that working within the existing European treaties, we could set up some of the mechanisms to get public investment into the countries that need it, to get social insurance where it was needed, to deal with banking problems, to deal with the problem of an unpayable public debt. And so that was initially the hope, that there might be some path that could be done legally, could be done within the existing European treaties. What we found is that politically there was no interest, no appetite, no willingness to reconsider the path that they're on. And so having stuck to that path and having really crammed it down the throats of the Greeks over the last 5 months, the Europeans are in a position, they're really still on a trajectory toward one of the two things that you just mentioned. Now, they're clearly not going to get a federal state. That's what the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, actually would like. And he's, you know, he's an...
That would essentially be Germany winning World War II.
No, that's not fair.
We now control the
country. No, that's not fair.
Okay.
Germany is a fully functioning democracy.
Yeah,
it just happens to be the core of the European Union, which has all of the industrial powers concentrated there.
We'll continue this conversation right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Professor James K. Galbraith is with us, and we'll be back. I want to get into also what's going on with the U.S. economy. Where are we and where are we going? Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. James K. Galbraith is with us in the studio, and we're honored to have you, sir, one of our nation's, and I'd say one of the world's most competent and well-known economists, just extraordinary work. He's here for a Roosevelt Institute gig with Joe Stiglitz and Bernie Sanders over in the Hart office building. And just to wrap up our conversation about Greece, we were talking off the air about the J curve, about when expectations diverge from reality, that at some particular threshold, that's when revolution happens. And I was asking you, and you were in Greece. I was asking you, are the Greeks moving down that road? Are they getting close to a J-curve breaking point, as it were?
I think that's already happened in important ways. The previous Greek system was an exchange of parties between two center-left, center-right party, both of which have collapsed.
Right.
The result was the rise of a left-wing party, which had never before been in power, the group of activists and ecologists and trade unionists and college professors.
As if Bernie Sanders won the White House.
It is exactly as if. The extraordinary thing is that very shortly after the election, the approval ratings of that government reached about 80%, and they haven't fallen that much. They're still well up there. I mean, if there were a new election, there's no question that Syriza would be returned. Alexis Tsipras, it turns out, has become the last man standing in Greek politics with very solid popular support, even though he was forced to capitulate on the economic policy questions. And there was a real sense in the rest of Europe that they could perhaps force this guy out of power. Mm-hmm. But now the world is coming to grips with the fact that this is, I think, likely to be a long-term phenomenon and very likely to spread to other countries eventually, that we're going to see new political forces and progressive political forces on the rise as people begin to say, really, we've had enough.
Is that the rise of progressive political forces in Europe, which has been basically embracing Thatcherism, what we call Reaganomics here, for the last couple of decades anyway?
30 years, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in a really big way.
True.
I lived in Germany in 86, and they were just starting to make that transition with, their healthcare system and everything. I mean, it seems to me that this slamming down Greece is about regime change more than anything else.
Yeah, that was the idea, and that term was used. It's a very ugly term. We used it to describe what we were going to do to Saddam Hussein.
Right.
It's been used by certain people to describe what they'd like to do in Iran or Syria. But this is a democratically elected country, a NATO ally, a member of the European Union. It's a preposterous term to use in that setting. And people who tried to do it discovered that they got their heads handed to them politically in Greece. So it's the Greek people, I think, really gave a terrific political shock to this neoliberal, basically reactionary consensus, which is in control in most of the other countries.
So does that mean that Thatcherism has passed its prime and it's doomed?
Oh, long past, and we're now seeing the implications of the basically non-viability of that system in Europe.
So Greece was a emperor has no clothes moment.
Definitely anyway, so
for the European
and remarkably, what the Greeks had going for them was a clear vision of why that was the case. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons why Syriza rose so rapidly, is that they could read for themselves. This was the work, basically, of Yanis Varoufakis and his contribution. And I think it's been a pleasure working with Yanis.
He's been pushed out, though.
He's back on. He left. He left the finance ministry because he could not put his signature on to the terms of surrender.
Right.
But he's still in parliament, and he's definitely still a force to be reckoned with in Greece.
So we're here in the United States experiencing something the same but different,
yeah,
as
sure.
it were.
Yeah,
we,
yeah, sure.
we have had 36 years now of, mm-hmm. if my math is correct, of Reaganism.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not unlike Hardingism, you know, led right mm-hmm. to Hooverism. I'm curious your thoughts on the American economy. You know, the Fed just had another meeting. We've got all this speculation about this, that, and the other thing. The future of the American economy, where we're at, you know, and I think in some ways in the presidential debates, we're seeing this writ large. The entire Republican Party is still totally embracing Reaganism, and the Democratic Party, you've got Bernie Sanders rising like a rocket, and he's the Syriza of the United States. And Hillary Clinton saying, well, let's go a middle way. I don't want to speak for Hillary, but it seems like her policies are more, you know, slow and incremental, which is kind of what Obama has been doing for the last 6.5 years. And I think Obama was elected to be a Tsipras, and he hasn't been. And I'm just curious your thoughts on all of that.
Well, I think there are parallels to be drawn. The United States does have the advantage of having relatively solid institutions at the national, the continental level. And so, again, Social Security works, Medicare and Medicaid works. We've made some progress. I mean, we didn't have the Affordable Care Act. Now we do. This is you can argue about whether it was the best thing, but it's an improvement over what was there before.
Yeah. And we own our own currency.
And we own our own currency, and we have a central bank directed by one of the most capable people who's ever been in charge of it, actually, in Janet Yellen. So I think we have a more, broadly speaking, a more pragmatic government, at least as far as the internal issues are concerned. But there are still a lot of people who've been left behind. There is a lot of strain on state and local government. There's huge strains on infrastructure, on local public services, on the availability of jobs. A lot of people have lost their jobs and not been able to find new ones. So there are enormous cracks in this edifice, and that's what's giving the impetus to a real desire to have a concrete and solid set of alternatives. And I think we'll see that developing in this country as time goes on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wrote a book called The Crash of 2016, mm-hmm. but it's essentially tracking the Powell memo to mm-hmm. today. It's about mm-hmm. how our politics have now hollowed out our economy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to be a...
This is a Lewis Powell.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
And, you know, which led mm-hmm. to then Lewis Powell authoring, when he was put on the Supreme Court the following year by Richard Nixon, authoring the Buckley versus Vallejo decision, which mm-hmm. said that, you know, money is free speech, which led right to Citizens United, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like we're experiencing in the United States both an economic crisis, in part from Phil Graham's activities. His wife Wendy was on the board of Enron. Ken mm-hmm. Lay wanted to be able to run his own bank because the bankers were given a hard time. So Phil Graham comes out with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Graham Leach Bliley.
Mm-hmm.
These changes have not been undone. Are the structures of our economy as rickety as it might seem? Or
certainly the financial structure is extremely rickety and remains so. It really hasn't recovered its integrity from the debacles of the 2000s that led to the collapse in 2008, 2009.
Right.
And until that happens, I think we have a hard time having a stable basis for growth that arises from, with the support of the financial sector. It was the great triumph of the New Deal that it disciplined finance for about 30 years, and then finance basically disencumbered itself.
And then along came Reagan.
Well, it was, let's be fair. This is also the responsibility of Democratic administrations. The Clinton administration was a deregulating administration. We saw a lot of bad policy under both parties.
Well, in the last 2 years of the Carter administration, in fact, there was a fair amount of deregulation.
There was, although the financial deregulation really comes in with Reagan, actually. Carter, you can talk about airlines and trucking and so forth, but but finance really hits in the 1980s.
Yeah, it almost seems like it was Margaret Thatcher's election in
definitely the Thatcherite element was very strong for sure.
So what in your opinion? We're talking with James Galbraith, Lloyd Benson, chair of government and business relations, professor of government at the University of Texas in Austin. What would your prescription be? What should we be doing? I mean, for example, Bernie Sanders is talking about change our trade policies so that money actually continues to circulate in the United States instead of all going to China two steps after a purchase, and reinstitute Glass-Steagall. You know, tell banks you got to choose. Are you going to be checkbook banks or gambling banks as a start? I mean, these are two of the pieces.
I think enforcement of prudential regulation on the banking sector is extremely important, and that's the thing which has been disabled. We have a record in this administration of non-action with respect to the worst financial frauds.
Like Eric Holder sending no banksters to jail. Is that what you're talking about?
Indeed. I mean, let's just take the case of HSBC, which was found responsible for it's not just financial fraud, but money laundering of Mexican drug money to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And they did not see fit to prosecute any officers of that bank, nor to revoke his license. This is something which sits as a stain, I think, on the whole record. But it also means that you can't really, if you're outside the system and asking, do you really want to entrust these people with, let's say, uninsured money? The answer would that be you think twice about it, because you know you're not dealing with a well-policed system.
Yeah. So, at the level of the individual, do you think that people would be well advised to get out of big banks and into credit unions, for example, just as a small protection?
You have at the level of the individual, you have the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. I think you can rely on that.
Yeah.
So it's not really a question of whether your deposits are safe, but whether you're in an institution that is going to have good lending practices. And from that point of view, yes, the credit unions, the regional banks, the institutions which never got into these games.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
James Galbraith, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Great to have you with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, Goat.com, and Free-Don.org. And I am honored, genuinely honored, to have in the studio with me.
Finally. I've been away, traveling around like a
Ellen
crazy Manor. Person,
yep.
Right?
Ellen. And 50 years ago today, Medicare was signed, and about a year before that, Ronald Reagan made a famous recording for the American Medical Association that was distributed to doctors all over the country, and then they distributed to patients. We've got a little clip
now, but before we play the clip, I just want to say I remember that day. It was a month before my 14th birthday. My father died. My mother married a doctor. We were living in Memphis, Tennessee. And you're right. He must have listened to that recording, because they were furious about Medicare. It was going to ruin American medicine. And now, by the way, the Republicans are saying they're the ones that are saving Medicare.
Amazing. Well, let's hear what Reagan had to say. See if this is interesting.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. It's very easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project. Most people are a little reluctant to oppose anything that suggests medical care for people who possibly can't afford it. Now, the American people, if you put it to them about socialized medicine and gave them a chance to choose, would unhesitatingly vote against it. We had an example of this under the Truman administration. It was proposed that we have a compulsory health insurance program for all people in the United States. And, of course, the American people unhesitatingly rejected this. So, with the American people on record as not wanting socialized medicine, Congressman Farrand introduced the Farrand Bill. This was the idea that all people of Social Security age should be brought under a program of...
Anyhow, we'll come back to the news. Reagan is droning on.
But he did that, and people liked him for some crazy reason. Anyhow, so the Republicans put out something today saying that they did the docs fix and that they have protected seniors in health care.
Really?
It boggles my mind, but they did.
The Republicans who want to privatize Medicare, voucherize it, Paul Ryan, over and over and over again, let's turn this into vouchers, they just said that they're protecting the seniors.
Earlier this year, Republicans passed reforms to Medicare to continue protecting seniors and improve health care.
That's from a Republican press release.
Excellent. You know, I watch the Republican press releases. But speaking of health care, the president today implemented the HIV/AIDS strategy for the years 2015 to 2020. They're asking the Secretary of State to report on how the government can do a government-wide response to domestic HIV/AIDS epidemic. They're also asking that the Equal Employment Commission talk about how people with HIV can gain more employment. Many things in this particular executive order that was issued today.
Wow, good stuff.
Okay. Now, interesting, I got this from our friends at Friends of the Earth. They said that the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources passed a bill, and this is the final markup on energy policy modernization, but it omitted any provisions to increase renewable energy. However, our friend Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a provision to take the adoption of solar, but the committee shot it down. Of course.
He also tried to insert a provision that simply acknowledged the reality of climate change. The Republicans shot that down, too.
Yeah, well, of course. And even some Democrats shot this down.
Oh, jeez.
Right. Okay.
Don't get me started.
Now, the Democrats have an August messaging plan, which somehow leaked to the Republicans. So now they put out another press release. Call me the Republican press release person today, talking about how the Democrats were trying to talk about their successes and what Republicans can do to essentially shoot it down. Of course, the Voting Rights Act, immigration, Make It in America, student debt relief. So the Republicans are going after the Democrats for their messaging point, which somebody actually released to the Republican Party.
Hmm.
Interestingly enough. Okay. Also, it is a date as Hillary Clinton will testify on Benghazi on October 22nd. She is expected to go before the special Benghazi committee. There is actually going to be tomorrow more releasing of her documents. This is part of that court order that happened over a period of time saying these documents will be released in this order.
Wow. Drip.
Yes. Now, I'm going to be in the great state of Ohio next week for the debate. And as you know, there was a university policeman that was charged in the murder of a black man on campus. University of Cincinnati discharged him, got rid of him and put him on whatever, probation or whatever. And so he was actually indicted. He was jailed overnight, et cetera. Now, also, Planned Parenthood is fighting back. They have this, fake firm Biomax, which is the one. But a court actually said today that the Center for Medical Progress, this was done by a Los Angeles Superior Court, cannot release any more video from their fake videos because of the way they're edited, et cetera.
Because of the way they're edited?
Just because they did this surreptitiously, and also, of course, they were edited down, fake edited,
so
all that kind of stuff.
So they didn't stop it because it was a violation of the wiretap laws, where
I'm not exactly. I didn't see
consent.
The actual.
Yeah.
My
guess
court
is
order.
That that would be the basis.
Or
of
both.
It. Yeah.
Possibly both.
Yeah.
Okay. The Senate also went in and approved the 6-year highway bill today. Now, as you know, the House, before it went on recess, passed a 3-monther.
Right.
And so that's kind of interesting. And however, they put the Senate bill, it increases the import-export bank for 5 years. It's run by Fred Hochberg. But also, how are they going to pay for some of this? This is quite shocking, actually, by selling oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Really?
Yes. That is how the Senate bill plans on paying for some of this. It's shocking.
Sell your silverware. Sell your jewelry to pay your rent.
Right. So Mitch McConnell said they weren't going to increase the gas tax. So this is they're not increasing the gas tax routine.
This is bizarre. This is these Republicans live in a parallel universe. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com.
And freedan.org.
And yeah, free-don.org. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ellen. Great to have you with
us. Thank you.
We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are just about to be hit here in Washington, D.C. You can see or not see behind me if you're watching on TV. It just suddenly got dark. I mean, it's like night right now. We're about to be hit with a whopper thunderstorm. So if you lose us or if we lose you or whatever, that's what happened. It wasn't the Republicans. Well, actually, it was. I mean, the whopper thunderstorms are the result of global climate change. And anyhow, Lamar Waldron is on the line with us. He's a JFK historian, the author of Watergate, The Hidden History, Nixon, the Mafia, and the CIA, the co-author, along with me, of Ultimate Sacrifice. Actually, I'm the co-author. Lamar's the principal author of Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy. His website is WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com. Lamar, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
It's great to have you. So today is the not only the 50th anniversary of Medicare, it's the 40th anniversary of the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. Tell me about this.
Well, you know, it's been 40 years now. He was murdered on July 30th, 1975. And we're going to be talking today about a previously unknown, very secret FBI investigation into Jimmy Hoffa's murder, an investigation that occurred down in New Orleans. It was an investigation so secret that the FBI withheld the information about this investigation from Congress for a decade and a half, and they're still hiding most of the information about it today. They've hidden it from the press, they've hidden it from the public, and as far as anyone can tell, they've probably even hidden it from Jimmy Hoffa's own family.
So tell me, this is astonishing. I understand that after Nixon resigned, his first, and this you're saying he was murdered in 73. That was the year that Nixon resigned, right?
No, he was murdered in, Hoffa was murdered.
Oh, 75.
Right. July 30th, 1975. Nixon had resigned back in August of 1974. So at the time of Hoffa's murder, Nixon had resigned in disgrace. We all have seen pictures, even if we weren't around in those days, like you and I, of, you know, him, you know, waving and then helicoptering away from the White House. And he remained in total seclusion after that through the time of Hoffa's murder until about 9 weeks after Jimmy Hoffa's murder.
And then when he came out of seclusion, he was hanging out with two guys who were
the top suspects in Jimmy Hoffa's murder. And this wasn't like a private thing. He went to this big charity-type golf tournament in Southern California at this really fancy golf resort, and he was playing golf in public. You know, this is how he chose to emerge from seclusion. At that point, it had been more than a year after his resignation, to play golf with the two top suspects of Jimmy Hoffa's, you know, murder, you know, that had at that point occurred just 9 weeks earlier, which, you know, when biographers like Stephen Ambrose wrote about that, or when the New York Times reported, so this was like a very public thing, they were just baffled. They were like, what on earth is going on? Why is Nixon playing golf with the two top suspects in Hoffa's murder? As people hear what you and I are going to be talking about today, that will become very clear why he would be playing golf with the two top suspects.
Well, let's get right to that. Who were those people, and why was he playing golf with it?
Well,
I'm assuming that this tracks back to Nixon in 1959 as vice president taking a massive bribe from Jimmy Hoffa to get out of the Sun Valley land deal indictment.
You're exactly right. It all goes back to 1959. The two gentlemen, to use that word loosely, that Nixon was playing golf with were Frank Fitzsimmons, the president of the Teamsters Union, who had taken over after Jimmy Hoffa had been sent to prison. You know, the Kennedys had been trying to put the corrupt Jimmy Hoffa away since the late 1950s, when they had their big investigation of the Teamsters and the Mafia, and they were dragging these mob bosses like Sam Giancana in front of the committee. And the Kennedys really made their bones, both of them, and really propelled JFK to the White House by going after Hoffa and the Mafia in the late 50s. When Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, he was never able to put Hoffa in prison. That did eventually happen because John and Robert Kennedy had set into motion just a huge increase in the Justice Department of people going after mobsters and people like Jimmy Hoffa, who was the ally of the Mafia. So Frank Fitzsimmons took over for Jimmy Hoffa. Frank Fitzsimmons was part of Nixon got two big bribes from the Mafia. One, actually, it was in 1960, and the other bribe was in 1971. Nixon got two big bribes. One was, as you said, to stall charges in a Sun Valley land deal back in 1960 when Richard Nixon was vice president,
right,
running against Senator John F. Kennedy. The second Nixon-Hoffa Mafia bribe was in late 1971. This was instead of $1 million, as it had been in 1960, it was $1.5 million, $1 million to Nixon's reelection campaign, because the 72 election was about to come up, and $500,000 straight to Nixon just, you know, for his own pocket money. So Frank Fitzsimmons, of course, was a very big suspect because Frank Fitzsimmons did not want to give up the presidency of the Teamsters.
Right, he was the beneficiary of the death of Hoffa, essentially.
Very, very much the direct, beneficiary. So he was at the very high on the FBI's list. And then there was a New Jersey mobster who had a Teamster local, but he was also in the one of the New York mafia families, a guy by the name of Tony Provenzano. And Provenzano had been part of the 1960 bribe to Richard Nixon for Hoffa, along with some godfathers, that names that some of your listeners will recognize, people like the godfather of Texas and Louisiana named Carlos Marcello, the godfather of Tampa, Florida, the big man behind America's French Connection heroin network, a godfather by the name of Santo Trafficante.
The guys who killed Kennedy.
Right, who later confessed to killing Kennedy. And plus, even Sam Giancana, you know, Nixon had been dogged for years by rumors that, and has been dogged today by historians who don't do your homework, that somehow Kennedy was elected thanks to Sam Giancana, as if any Democrat needed the help of the Mafia to carry Chicago overwhelmingly, especially when they had the powerful mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley, as a very close Kennedy aide. But even Sam Giancana himself had also contributed to the big bribe back in 1960. So, but what's important for our story here is several weeks before Jimmy Hoffa was murdered, Sam Giancana was murdered as well by someone he knew. He was murdered in unusual fashion. His head wasn't blown off. They used a .22 caliber pistol, very small for a mafia hit, but they shot him several times around the mouth and chin, a sign that Giancana shouldn't have talked, and nobody else should talk either, because at that time, the Senate, headed by Senator Frank Church, were investigating the 1959 and 1960 plots to kill Fidel Castro that Richard Nixon had been behind, and Jimmy Hoffa had been the first liaison between Nixon, the Mafia, and the CIA. When that didn't work out, they kind of upped it and got Sam Giancana's, a mafia don of Sam Giancana's by the name of Johnny Roselli, to kind of up the ante. And also Carlos Marcello worked for the CIA on those plots, and also Santo Trafficante worked on those plots. So the Senate was digging into those plots in the winter, spring, and summer of 1975. Jimmy Hoffa had started out by leaking information about Nixon and those plots, first to the Senate Watergate Committee, and then he was providing information to the Church Committee through an intermediary. Somehow the mafia apparently found that out, and plus the other unusual coincidence is on the very day Hoffa was murdered, Richard Nixon's rival in the 1972 campaign, Senator George McGovern, was releasing a report that he had just gotten from Fidel Castro that was about those plots that started under Vice President Nixon about killing Fidel Castro.
And so this takes us to Watergate, and we'll cover that in just a few minutes. Stick around. We'll be back. Lamar Waldron's with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is Watergate, thehiddenhistory.com. Stick around. Welcome back, Lamar. So Nixon is responsible for, you know, not only is this the 40-something, the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Jimmy Hoffa, but it's also is it this week that the flag went up at the Cuban embassy? Was it Monday?
The flag, well, John, you know, the embassy, from what I understand from my research, the embassy is kind of open and operating as an embassy, but the official flag raising is going to occur on August the 14th, when Secretary of State John Kerry goes to Cuba and will kind of preside over the big official ceremony.
Right. And that'll be the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba.
Right, right. And the man that we have to thank for closing that embassy in the first place is none other than the same guy we've been talking about, Richard Nixon. When he was vice president, the embassy was closed back on January the 3rd of 1961. Now, that was a few weeks before Senator John F. Kennedy became President Kennedy. And so that was kind of a little parting gift that Nixon gave to his hated rival, JFK, because Nixon had just lost the election, a very close election, to JFK. There's again, if people don't do a lot of research, Nixon liked to say, well, yeah, he heard about irregularities, but, you know, he decided to be a big man about it and just let JFK have the presidency. Wrong. Nixon operated through intermediaries. I mean, Nixon wasn't burglarizing the Watergate. He had, you know, these ex-CIA people and current CIA people do it for him. Nixon had the head of the Republican Party file all sorts of challenges against JFK. They weren't good. There were irregularities in Illinois, not just some in Chicago, but also downstate as well that benefited Richard Nixon. There were other states that had irregularities that benefited Richard Nixon. So Nixon was very angry about losing that election. The whole point of killing Fidel Castro before the 1960 election was so that people would stick with the 8-year vice president, Richard Nixon, right, while, you know, U.S. troops were being sent into Cuba after Castro's assassination, and they wouldn't go with the young, relatively untested Senator John F. Kennedy, because at that point, Senator Kennedy's only real national profile experience was going after the mafia and Jimmy Hoffa. And so the mafia and Jimmy Hoffa were huge supporters of Richard Nixon. You know, they gave him the $1 million bribe that was to stall the charges and also give Nixon campaign money and also to give Nixon support from the Teamsters, because union support was in short supply for a Republican anti-union candidate like Richard Nixon. Flash ahead to 1971, it's deja vu all over again, as someone once said. And so you again have an even bigger bribe from the mafia to Nixon, this time to get Hoffa out of prison, where Bobby Kennedy's efforts had eventually, after Bobby had resigned as attorney general to become senator and had tragically been assassinated himself. Hoffa had been in prison, and he was released, but with a huge condition that Hoffa had never been told about. And that was he could not run again for Teamster president until 1980. Hmm. He hated that. That's why Hoffa immediately started leaking information to the Watergate Committee and later on to the Church Committee. And that basically signed his death warrant when a Time magazine article appeared a few weeks before his death. And then McGovern had called this press conference to release this big Cuban dossier.
Right. Hang on just a second, Lamar. We'll be right back. Twenty minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lamar Waldron still with us. We will be picking up your calls at the bottom of the hour here. Back to Anything Goes Summer. But right now, I wanted to hear about this. Today is the 40th. It's the 50th anniversary of Medicare. It's the 40th anniversary of the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. And Richard Nixon plays right in the middle of this whole thing. 2 weeks. Well, Lamar, refresh us here. Was it George McGovern, did you say?
Right. George McGovern had called a press conference. So this had been announced ahead of time that he was going to release this report, this huge dossier that he had gotten, had just gotten. He had been to Cuba a couple of months earlier, and he had just gotten this from Fidel Castro himself. And it was a big 100-plus page dossier of the CIA's attempts to kill
CIA and the Mafia's attempts to kill...
Well, the CIA and the Mafia's, and they, of course, had begun under Vice President Richard Nixon. President Eisenhower, in the late 50s, had been so frustrated with Cuba, he had delegated Cuba. It's pretty much the only area of government he delegated to Richard Nixon was Cuba. And so it had been up to Nixon to meet with Castro when he came to Washington, and instead of giving Castro the help that the Cuban people desperately needed, he got a lecture from Nixon, and Nixon immediately started working with Jimmy Hoffa to use Hoffa's mafia friends to try to kill Fidel Castro. When that didn't work by the summer of 60, they kind of upped the ante, kind of paid Hoffa off, got this new set of mobsters, Marcello Trafficante and Roselli and Sam Giancana. And at the same time, there was a big payoff to Nixon to stall the charges against Hoffa. The same thing almost exactly happens in late 1971. There was even a new assassination plot against Castro that was in that report. They didn't know what was in that report. By the way, we won't go into detail here, but that report was what the Watergate burglars had been looking for in the four break-in attempts at the Watergate office complex.
McGovern never released it.
No. So the report had existed. Actually, the first place the Watergate burglars burglarized was the Chilean embassy. At that time, had the very socialist, progressive government of Allende. The CIA had heard it was there. They broke in. They only found part of it. They were desperate to find this report because they didn't know if it would have the bribes. Nixon knew, the Justice Department know. Did Castro know about the bribes? You know, the fact that Nixon had ordered the mafia. They didn't know exactly what that report would say. That's why they were breaking in to the Watergate to try to find, on Nixon's orders. But so McGovern did release this report. But guess what? You know, guess what kept that off the front page of all the newspapers in America was Jimmy Hoffa's murder. So most people today don't realize that report existed. I actually put it, you know, pretty much most of the report in the book, The Hidden History of Watergate. And so people can actually see that. That report got released. It actually was not quite as damaging as Hoffa and the Mafia Godfathers had worried. I mean, it had damaging information, to be sure. It didn't actually name Jimmy Hoffa, but again, they didn't know that. And so, because they hadn't seen that report, that even the Watergate burglars...
So Hoffa continuing alive represented an existential threat to the Mafia and to Richard Nixon. Was Richard Nixon part of the murder of Jimmy Hoffa?
Not at all. Nixon, I think, was very frightened by that murder. Remember, several weeks before Hoffa, Sam Giancana, slated to testify to that Senate committee investigating the CIA mafia plots, the Watergate committee had already folded. They had been hidden pretty much almost completely from the Watergate committee, except who did interview Roselli, then that got shut down mysteriously. Watergate committee was gone. Senate Church Committee was investigating. Sam Giancana, after it's publicized, he is going to be testifying. He is murdered. I think the first murder of an upcoming Senate witness. Hoffa was also on the radar screen of the committee. He had been providing behind the scenes information. Time magazine had written a story. You know, in other words, somebody from the committee had kind of leaked to Time magazine. Now that was out. It was obvious Hoffa was leaking. If he got called and put under oath, everything was over. So the mafia had to kill him. He was also, by the way, he did want to get around somehow that restriction that kept him away from the Teamster. So that was the other big thing, because
right.
the Mafia
so,
was much happier with Franklin.
So Nixon wasn't directly involved with the murder of Hoffa, but it was Nixon's...
He was afraid that he was going to wind up like Jimmy Hoffa, like Sam Giancana, and just like Johnny Roselli the following year would be murdered and wind up in a 55-gallon oil drum. I think that's why Nixon had been dealing with the Mafia since literally day one
since
of
the
his
40s.
Political life. So that was nothing unusual. He'd been dealing with these guys for years, and I think this was Nixon's way of showing, hey, what happened to Sam Giancana? What happened to Jimmy Hoffa? What happened to John F. Kennedy? What happened to Robert Kennedy? You don't need to do that to me, because I'm going to play ball with you guys. Look, I'm playing golf with you. That's why that's why Nixon was playing golf with two of the people involved in Hoffa's murder. But I shouldn't mention, so there was a secret FBI investigation of Jimmy Hoffa's murder back in 1985, 10 years after Hoffa was murdered.
1 minute, Lamar.
And the FBI had a wiretap on Carlos Marcello in prison. Those tapes had never been released, but I have documents about that from the FBI file. I interviewed the FBI informant, Marcello's cellmate, Jack Van Lanningham, and Marcello said that prior to Hoffa's murder, he and Tony Provenzano had brought Hoffa down to Marcello had this huge Churchill Farms estate, you know, way over 1,000 acres, private airstrip, to talk sense into him, to tell him, look, you need to stay away from the Teamsters, we need to keep Fitzsimmons in, probably also to say, look, you shouldn't talk to these congressional committees. It did not go well. And so, according to some versions of the account, Hoffa was murdered down there. And in fact, Hoffa's last call that he made, his last known call, was to a family member, and he said he was going to the airport up in Michigan. So he may have been flown that day. It's also possible from close reading of the FBI calls he was flown down like a week earlier, refused to play ball.
What happened to the Maccas Red Fox, the restaurant in Detroit?
That's exactly right. And that was the last place he was ever seen alive. But the FBI did a secret investigation of an auto salvage yard in New Orleans, because they thought whether he was murdered in New Orleans or murdered in Michigan and the body taken to New Orleans, that's where he wound up.
Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with your calls and anything goes. Summer, Richard Nixon. Lamar Waldron is with us, and the website is WatergateTheHiddenHistory.com. Thank you, Lamar.
Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate it.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. And to those of you who've been patiently waiting to get on and Thomas in Flint, Michigan, listening on FYI Nation. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hey, I'm wondering, who is Jim Gilmore and why is he running for president?
Jim Gilmore is the former Republican, governor of Virginia, isn't he?
I heard that because Fox and Frauds had Governor Walker on, and they had mentioned him, and I was like, wait, what, there's another guy?
Yeah. What did you call, was that the Fox and Friends show you had a name for?
Yes, well, I usually call it Fox and Frauds, F-A-U-X and Frauds, because they are.
Huh.
So, because they had Walker on talking about the Iran deal and everything else.
Yeah.
And they mentioned him, and I was like, wait a minute, this is new. Where did this come from?
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting. I think right now, any Republican who wants to, make $1 million, basically, or more, who wants to set themselves up for the rest of their life and have something that they can pass along to their kids, is throwing their hat into the Republican race to basically do a Sarah Palin. I mean, Sarah Palin, she's got a super PAC, and she's got a website, and she takes money from contributors and average working people, and she sells books, and she's gotten quite wealthy on being on having run for vice president, and all these Republican candidates, there is a giant loophole in the campaign finance law that says that You know, if a super PAC raises a whole bunch of money and doesn't spend it all, you can keep the money. And plus, you know, you get on a national stage on Fox so-called news, and you get to promote your books. And so I'm surprised that there's only, what is he, number 17 now or number 16?
Yeah, number 17.
Number 17. I'm surprised there's not 30 or 40 of them, frankly. I mean, I'm thinking of changing my party affiliation and running for president myself as a Republican. It's like, you know, Louise and I could use a little more cash before we retire, you know? It's serious stuff.
Right?
I think that's what's going on, frankly. I really do. I'm color me cynical, but I can't come up with a better explanation. Jim Gilmore has he doesn't have a snowball's chance in hell of becoming president or even becoming close to becoming president. So why else would he do it other than to raise the value of his brand?
Do you think some of these guys are in Carly Fiorino?
Yeah, I mean, the only serious candidates are, you know, Chris Christie, Scott Walker, Jeb Bush. You know, Marco Rubio is really running for vice president. He's so young, nobody's going to take him seriously for president. But he would make a very good and strategic vice president for somebody like Scott Walker, who is, you know, northern blue state, and Rubio is southern Florida, and Rubio can bring the Hispanic voter. At least that's the theory. And, you know, but so there's a couple of them who I think are running for vice president. But the vast majority of them are running for, you know, padding their 401ks, you know, or their retirements. That's really what's going on. Thomas, got to move along, but thank you for the call. Irene in Meridian, Idaho. You were at a Bernie rally tonight, last night?
Yes, it was really surprising because we saw on the internet they were going to have a house party.
Mm-hmm.
And the young fellow, we didn't know how young he was, but we're in our 80s, and we thought, well, Gene sent money to Bernie when he heard he announced.
Right.
And so we've always been, loved him, and I've listened to him on your program forever.
Yeah.
And he ended up, he had room for 30 people. Well, he already had 50 people in 4 hours.
Whoa.
And so then Gene said, well, you need another venue. So then they got to looking around, and then one of his young friends, and this kid, we didn't know he was that young.
Mm-hmm.
He's like 21.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the young Democrats at BSU to get the room down their patio.
Hmm.
So we had probably 200 in there last night and listened to the speech and everything, and everybody signed up.
Wow, that's great.
And then there was one black man that came in, young black man, and he says, well, I came here because I want to know more about him. I don't know much about him.
Right.
And so we kind of talked about that. And then that was our, and then I heard later that, or sometime, that there was about 9 house parties around Boise.
Wow. Yeah.
Which I thought was really surprising.
It was a nationwide event, over 100,000 people. This has never happened in the political history of the United States of America, and the U.S. corporate media is pretending it didn't happen.
I know, and the other thing is I have a son that lives in Bellevue, Washington. Of course, that man called in and said they were full up for 20-mile radius.
Oh, same here in D.C.
Bellevue, Washington.
Yeah.
And then my son says, well, I have 2 grandchildren going to school, Wazoo, and he said they're really a flutter over, so I didn't hear what happened there. But I thought it's quite exciting.
Yes, it's happening all over the country. Irene, thanks for the report, and thanks for listening in.
Thought you'd like to know that Boise's not that far behind. We really are a progressive town, considering our outlying areas.
Yes, yeah, it's great. And thanks for listening to the web stream for WCPT. Thank you, Irene. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, what's up? Albert? Albert, if you can hear me, I can't hear you, so please call right back, okay? Michael in Silver Spring, Maryland. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Hey, one suggestion and 2 quick points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy that you had on in the first hour, Black Lives Matter, what's his name, Mr. Freeman?
Yeah, Kimon Freeman.
This is only a suggestion. I think he ought to have a segment once a week on your show.
Yeah.
Like, as a black advisor, like Bernie, I think Bernie should hire 6 or 7 black advisors to his campaign, and 6 or 7 Latino advisors to his campaign. But I really called about the restaurant situation.
Okay.
That you talked about in the first hour. Now, what they're doing now in the restaurants is they're seating blacks around the kitchen where it's noisy, the doors back and forth, it's clanking and clanking, and they're seating blacks around the waiter stations where it's clinking and clanking and noise being making. Every time I go into a restaurant, they start heading towards one of those two locations. I'll go, can we go over here by ourselves, by the front?
Yeah.
I prefer that.
Yeah.
And also about the Black Lives Matter, I think Black Lives Matter and black folks should be protesting in front of these cops' homes so that when we leave, and we're out in the street, and they come to our homes, we're in fear. So when they leave their own home to go to work, and they got 100 black protesters out front, and their families are still there, that they're leaving and feeling the same fear by having to go to work and have 100 protesters out in front of their home. So they feel the same thing, and they will be less apt to pull that trigger because they'll know that Bob and John had their homes protested, and that kind of fear of leaving your family, sitting there with 100 black people out with signs and protesting, that now they'll think twice on pulling that trigger.
Yeah.
Because when we leave our home or they come to our homes, we might get shot and we call the police for help and we might be the victim.
Right.
Or
right.
In our own cars.
Yeah.
But yeah. That,
Clay,
I'm sorry.
It's fine. Forgive my interruption. I thought you were pretty much done. Don't you think that this officer, I'm forgetting his name now, the cop who killed Mr. DeBose in Cincinnati, being dragged in front of the judge today and a $1 million bail set, which surprised me. I didn't think that you could set bail for murder. Of course, I guess this wasn't murder one. This was not premeditated. This was, but whatever. Although maybe it was. I mean, who knows? But don't you think that, a police officer's being, this is the second time, a cop has been indicted for murdering an unarmed black man. Don't you think that's the beginning of something that is going to cause police around the country to think twice?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I really don't think so. I think they looking at it in percentages. That's only two out of history.
Right.
And it's going to happen next week and the week after. It's going to be another one. But I'm staunch on protesting in front of their homes, because it's not only white privilege, but it's white fear. These whites are terrified of black people. Just the imagery that is projected through our media,
yep.
Through videos and rap music and all kinds of stuff. They don't have no black friends to counteract what they're seeing in their living room, on TV and on videos and hearing in the music. They have no black friends.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, Michael. I think that's a very important point. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Thanks for calling in. Much appreciated. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls. Anything goes summer right after this. And welcome back. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up? Johnny? We must be having Comcast troubles here. Johnny, call right back. I can't hear you. Louise in Tulare, California. Am I saying that right, Louise? Watching Free Speech?
You'll get it eventually. It's Tulare, California.
Tulare. That's right. I screwed it up last time, too, didn't I? What's up?
It's all right. So this is a majority Republican town, so it was great being at that local Bernie event yesterday. It's a small town, so there was people from other towns from around here, mm-hmm. and all the towns are majority Republican. So it was great being in a room of about, I think it was about 50 people that showed up. I mean, it was filled to capacity. The guy actually originally wanted to host it at his house, but he had to move it to a hotel conference room. And, you know, we went around the room talking about the issues that we really care about. And it was just great, you know, in a majority Republican town, seeing people that care about income inequality, that care about universal health care, that care about, you know, allowing unions to form. And one thing we did that, you know, I see is having a big impact is that the day before the meeting, I started a Facebook group. And originally I was going to call it Tulare for Bernie Sanders, but I thought, no, you know, all these towns are small towns and we have family all over here. So I called it Tulare County for Bernie Sanders. Hmm. And I told people there at the meeting to invite family that they know are in favor of Bernie. And maybe, you know, they can dedicate an hour or two a week, maybe the weekend. And, you know, that was last night, of course. And all this morning I've had requests and requests of people that want to join the group. And these are people that I've never even met. And, you know, they're all from around town. And I mean, I'm already up to like 60 something members on that Facebook group. So I would just recommend to your listeners, especially if you live in small towns where you don't know how to get started, how to get a movement going, start a Facebook group. You know, almost everybody's on Facebook. And I was telling the people at our meeting that Hispanic people or Spanish speaking people, they use Facebook a lot too. I mean, both of my parents are immigrants. And that's how we keep in touch with our family in Mexico. So, you know, they're Spanish speakers. And if you can get some bilingual people to help you out with that Facebook group, that way you can be posting announcements both in English and Spanish. That would help a lot. And that's how we're going to be using it. We're going to be using it to coordinate events, to get the word out. If we're going to have events, we're going to be registering voters or, you know, just discussing the issues, especially leading up to the primary debates, because the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz are not helping Bernie. They're actually, like you said, I think you mentioned this, they're protecting Hillary. They're protecting Hillary because she doesn't need the exposure. You know, everybody knows Hillary since the 90s. It's right. Bernie that needs the exposure. Right. And they're only going to give him 6 debates when back in 2008 it was like 20-something debates,
right.
Which started back in April of 2007.
Plus there's a nationwide media blackout on Bernie with regard to the corporate media.
That's right, and that's why, and you know, and that's what he said on this. I think you said you weren't there, but you still watched it. But that's what he was saying, right? That he's counting on us. He's counting on us, and so I'm just thinking of any way I can help. And that so far, that Facebook group has been helping out a lot, just to recruit people. And I posted today, you know, if you're interested in getting involved, but you weren't able to attend the meeting, text, you know, like you guys said, text work to 8263. And, you know, everybody's liking that post, and people are just inviting family members and friends, and it's working out great. So I would suggest or recommend to your listeners that they do the same thing. Start a Facebook group.
Yeah. Louise, you are an example for us all. And thank you so much for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Karen in Elk Grove, Illinois. Hey, Karen, you had a Bernie meeting last night? Karen, listening on WCPT? Oh, come on. Karen, if you can hear me, I can't hear you. Please call right back, and I'll put you right on the air. I'm sorry. Albert in Los Angeles. Albert, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Tom.
Okay, great. You're on the air.
All right. Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Just want to talk a little strategy with the TPP.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Democrats should hold the Iran deal hostage with Obama and unless he says he will veto TPP, he gets no Iran deal. Not to mention, if you just noticed, Ed Schultz, the only guy on MSNBC fighting for the removal of TPP or fighting against TPP, is now no longer affiliated with MSNBC.
Well, he is for another few weeks, but another week or so. But yeah, I get it, and I think it's a problem. It's a real problem. I, you know, Ed's a good guy. Albert, thank you for the suggestion. Jim in Crescent City, California. Hey, Jim, what's up? Thanks for listening to KGL.
Jim's Tom, not enough tennis courts. Listen, I'm going to talk to you about the, you know, there's a lot of health benefits in being a vegetarian, but there's something more important than that. You know what? If we could have gone back 50 years and everybody in America didn't kill or eat animals, you know, the problem is that vegetarians are very, very friendly people, and people that eat meat are hostile. You know, what's that chemical that eating meat puts into your system that makes you kind of violent? You know,
you're probably thinking about adrenaline.
I heard about
adrenaline. You know, when animals are killed, they're filled with fear, and so their adrenal glands are pumping out adrenaline and adrenochrome and all these other hormones, and they're the exact same hormones that we use. And so that transfers. Jim, I got a bunch of callers, and we're in the last, 4 minutes of the show. So thank you. You made a great point. Thank you for the call. Kim in Olive Branch, Mississippi. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Not much, Tom. What are the plans for movie plans for Legacy of Secrecy?
Watch this space. I'm going to Los Angeles this weekend to talk about that. Just watch this space. Well, I'll let you know. I can't talk about it right now, but it's still ongoing. So thanks for the call, Kim. Joseph in Bellevue, Washington. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Quick report on my house party for Bernie. A couple hours before the party, as a good omen, my brunch with Bernie Bear arrived.
Oh, great. Did you have any trolls at your Bernie party?
No.
Good.
No. I had a dozen people. They were generally middle-aged and older. There was basically three younger people. Mm-hmm. But that reflects the age of my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was very congenial. And after Bernie's presentation, we talked about what we could do and how a lot of issues that we all agreed. But we talked more about how to talk to people and how to present our arguments and what solutions Bernie has for these issues. And rather than discussing the issues, we pretty much all agree we have a bunch of issues. How do we relate?
Yeah. That's great. That's great. Joseph, thanks for the report. Thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Bernadine in Kauai, Hawaii. I'm sure I'm mangling the name. Bernadine?
Aloha. Yeah, it's Kihei, Hawaii.
Thank you.
And I went to the Bernie Sanders thing yesterday, and there was a conflict because there was also a protest against the TPP in Kanapali where they were meeting.
Uh-huh.
And there were so many police there that it was, you know, sort of intimidating.
Wow.
But anyway, back to the Bernie thing is my friend who went there, she said, yeah, he's just saying what they all say, but how is he going to pay for it? And his comment about people in prison, she was shocked when she found out that it costs $50,000 to $60,000 a year to incarcerate one person. And if our government wasn't paying that amount of money to incarcerate one person, you know, my son ended up with $20,000 in college debt for going for 4 years.
Right.
You know, if a person wasn't in prison and our government wasn't paying that could help pay for education.
Yep, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Bernadine, thank you for the call and thanks for the report. Florence in Rainier, Washington, an update on your Bernie event last night?
Yeah, we had 350 people turn up at the Capitol building in Olympia last night. I got my Bernie Bear as well, and we all wore Bernie hair, and we took this huge picture with our Bernie cutout. It was a lot of fun.
That is great. Send us a copy of it, and we'll post it on our Facebook page or our Twitter feed or whatever. In fact, I'll put you on hold and Danielle can tell you how to do that. Hang on just a second. She's on line 7, Danielle. Doug in Mifflin, Pennsylvania. You got the last minute of the hour of the show, Doug. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I know a while back Bernie had said that he would be interested in debating Republicans.
Right.
Republican candidates.
Right.
Well, with Fox doing this debate like they're doing with the top 10 and the polls, it's going to leave, what, 5 or 6 or 7 or so out.
No, they're doing a second debate now, Doug. They're doing it about 3 or 4 hours before the main debate for the second-tier candidates. So they're all going to have their moment in the sun. But your suggestion was Bernie should debate them, right?
Yeah, I mean, on the same night, go ahead. Maybe MSNBC or CNN or somebody would be interested in doing this. But I believe that if Bernie was to debate any one of these Republican candidates at the same time on the same night on a different channel other than Fox, I think they would get more viewers than Fox would to watch that show.
I think you're right, and I think he'd eat their lunch. Doug, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, and a great suggestion. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll be back tomorrow here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, in the meantime, democracy actually does depend on you. There are all these forces out there, the billionaires, the transnational corporations, the TPPers, who really don't like democratic processes. Democracy depends on all of us participating. So tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.